You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialised fiction written and read by Tansy Rainerot. Our current serial is Curse of Bronze. Chapter 9. From the Mouths of Gargoyles. The difference between a grotesque and a gargoyle, in a tradition going back over 1,000 years, is that a gargoyle has a water spout. The gargoyles on either side of the brass-bound red and black leather book were spouting now. Water gushed from their screaming mouths, emptying all over the floor. The armchairs drew back in alarm. The curtains daintily raised themselves up a few inches to avoid being splashed. The grotesque glossary was hot in Bella's hand, too hot to hold. She dropped it as she felt her fingers begin to burn. It sizzled when it hit the water, now sloshing around at ankle height. The golden book itself disappeared, and a cloud of blood-like liquid rose to the surface. "No!" Professor Tunbridge screamed. The water was getting warm. Too warm. Bella wondered if the armchairs would object if she climbed up on them. But before she could make a move, the gargoyles in the book began screaming again, in reverse. The water, now a faint pink colour, after the grotesque glossary had dissolved into it, sucked back up into the wide open mouths of the two gargoyles. The book itself started flapping like a wild bird. Bella struggled for a moment and then let go. The pages flipped back and forth, like some unearthly, invisible creature was trying to read them all at the same time. Finally, the brass-bound book fell open, both gargoyles facing down, onto an entirely dry rug. The pages, once blank, now held spiralling diagrams of hieroglyphs, similar but more complex to those that had appeared in the grotesque glossary. "That was bracing," said Mrs. McCabe, fanning herself with her hand. "It must be destroyed," said Professor Tunbridge. "In my professional opinion, no good will come from allowing that book to exist." Bella glanced at her in surprise. "But you're a linguist. Weren't you disappointed when the Tomb of the Nameless Pharaoh turned out to have no writing on it? Now, after all this time..."
25 years, to be exact.
"Some things should be left buried," said the professor, crossing her arms around her barrel-like chest. "Read it," said Selwa Gardner unexpectedly. She, with a sneering glance at Professor Tunbridge, "never gave a toss about what happened to my boy the night the tomb was uncovered. Charlotte believed our answers were in the gargoyle artifacts, and the first 28 gave us nothing. This one was our last hope." "These artifacts were buried over 1,000 years ago," said Bella. "They're not likely to solve a 25-year-old mystery." Selwa gave her that fierce, angry stare that made her far more intimidating than her werewolf sons. "Those words appeared in that book 5 minutes ago, so I reckon it's worth seeing what they say. Read it. Put us all out of our misery." Bella reached down and scooped up the book. The hieroglyphs wove around each other in a complex dance that could take decades to sort out into any practical coherence. A brand new language laid on the page before her, and she could not begin to imagine how to pronounce a single one of them.
"You can't," said Lionel softly. "I'm sorry, Bella. You won't be able to read it."
"Why not?" she cried in frustration. Surely this was the work she had trained for all her life. What was one more magical language to absorb? What would you know about it?
Charlotte Hathaway treated me as her personal librarian, he sighed. And that means I've studied every story, every thesis, every oral tradition about the origins of the nameless pharaoh. It's not a language for us. If it is a real language, then it's a language of transmutation and the inanimate. Legend suggests that only one living creature was ever able to use the language and wield its power, the nameless pharaoh himself.
That makes sense, said Mrs. McCarr reluctantly. According to his family, old Lord Quinfield claimed right to the end that he did not write the grotesque glossary. It used his pen and ink and hand and wrote itself. And of course no human has ever managed to copy the sigils. So, a human can't read the book, Bella agreed, thinking over the possibilities. She straightened her back and held the book out before her. Mrs. Teapot? I'm so very sorry for offending you earlier. I was somewhat distraught, but that is no excuse. I hope you'll accept my humblest apologies and be so gracious as to help me in my hour of need. As they all watched, the teapot made a sniffing sound. She turned around, spout towards Bella.
Well now, I don't know what all this fuss is about, no harm done, said Mrs. Teapot. Always happy to help the heir of the house, dearie, as long as I'm shown due respect. What do you need?
I need you to read this book, said Bella, out loud, right now.
You will doom us all, protested Professor Tunbridge. None of you were in that tomb. You haven't seen what I've seen. Destroy the book. Do not allow it to be read aloud.
Mrs. McCabe put a calm hand on her shoulder.
Let's not interfere, shall we? I, for one, am fascinated to listen to this excellent teapot.
Huffing and pleased with herself, Mrs. Teapot scooted back on the tea trolley. All the cups leapt out of the way so that the book could be laid before her open to the first page.
Perhaps Mr. Hope would be so kind to turn the pages for me. Thank you, dear. Well then, are you all sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
What followed was the most extraordinary sound uttered from the spout of the most genteel teapot in the known universe. It sounded like marble scraping over floorboards, like nails falling on a tin roof, like a door creaking into eternity. With every syllable she spoke, a hieroglyph floated up off the page and hovered in the air before her, forming a gradual wreath of glowing letters.
That's why the pharaoh has no name, said Mrs. McCabe. That's why there were no hieroglyphs on the tomb.
Someone had already read them aloud, agreed Bella. She saw Mrs. McCabe take a tighter, firmer grip on Professor Tunbridge's shoulder. She was, after all, the only person in the room who had been in that tomb when it was discovered.
You can't do this, said Professor Tunbridge, between gritted teeth. You will destroy the world.
Mrs. Teapot kept reading. Lionel could barely turn the pages fast enough to keep up with her. It all blurred together into a scraping haze of sound. Finally, the book was empty and fell shut. The glowing circle of light and hieroglyphs burned so brightly that they all winced and glanced away. And then the light was gone, leaving two disheveled young men standing in the middle of the room, back to back, and wild about the eyes.
Tag! Screamed Selwa Gardner.
The armchair released her, and she shot up out of its grasp, like a cheetah pouncing on prey. She seized one of the young men, an unshaven fellow with a mop of dark hair, and clasped him to her in a fierce embrace. The other one, who had sandy blonde hair and an equally uneven amount of chin stubble, turned around on unsteady feet and stared straight at Bella. She felt a shock of recognition, though he was far more dishevelled and unsmiling than the photographs she had pored over. But she saw her sisters in him, Faith and Charity. There was something about the tilt of his head, the shape of his mouth. She knew him. He was family. "You're not Charlotte or Christabel," he said roughly, taking one step towards her. "But..." His eye fell to the bronze key on the ribbon around her neck, and his breath caught in his throat. "I'm Bella," she said gently. "You're Colin Hathaway, aren't you? I'm Christabel's daughter, your niece." Gardner and Hathaway, the infamous tomb raiders. They were around her age when they disappeared, and by the looks of it, they had not aged a day. "You," said Ted Gardner, pulling away from his mother. Colin turned equally fierce. Both young men stared accusingly at Professor Tunbridge. She lifted her chin. "Boys, it's been a while." "Don't call us that," snapped Tag. "Nelly called us that," said Colin, "and you're not Nelly." "You may remove your hand," Professor Tunbridge said to Mrs. McCabe with icy professionalism. "No, I don't believe I will," replied Mrs. McCabe, equally polite. "Am I to understand that the two of you are the young archaeologists who were declared missing 25 years ago? 25 years, said Tag, looking taken aback. "Blimey." Bella found her voice. "If that is not Professor Nelly Tunbridge, then who is she?" Both Gardner and Hathaway spoke with a single voice, as if they were used to working on simultaneous problems. "The nameless pharaoh of the Tomb of Brass," they chorused. "Where we've been trapped for decades," added Colin Hathaway. "Because of her," said Tag Gardner in a vicious growl. Professor Tunbridge broke. Her hand flew up to hit Mrs. McCabe in the face, and then she surged away, powering into the hallway towards the front door. Bella winced and cried out, "Be careful!" even as she heard the smashing of glass and a truncated scream. Colin Hathaway, she noticed, called exactly the same thing. Tag Gardner turned and mouthed, "Be careful!" at him mockingly. "There's a lot of delicate cursed items in that hallway," Colin mumbled. "Excuse me," Bella said, breezing past them both, with Mrs. McCabe and Sergeant Stamp at her back. Professor Nelly Tunbridge lay prone on the hallway floor, covered in broken glass, and a cursed whip that had wrapped itself around both of her ankles. She had 4 tranquilizer darts sticking out of her chest. Her eyes glowed a disturbing shade of turquoise from edge to edge. "The nameless pharaoh of the Tomb of Brass," said Sergeant Stamp. "There's a thing. It's going to look rum in my report, and no mistake." "I shouldn't worry, Sergeant," said Mrs. McCabe. "I believe the Ministry will be taking care of most of the paperwork." The Ministry of Cold-Blooded Crimes took care of everything with an unsettling efficiency. Sturdy men in black suits and bowler hats arrived by the half-dozen to gently extract Professor Tunbridge, that is, the nameless pharaoh, from the cursed hallway. Despite the advice of Sergeant Stamp, Bella chose not to press charges against Selwa Gardner and her 2 younger sons for breaking and entering by magical means, though she breathed a sigh of relief when the lupine members of the Gardner family were escorted away to the Hattie Jenkins Centre for Injured Supernatural Beings to be checked over for curse damage. Sergeant Stamp himself went off to the station with two more cups of tea inside him, a spring in his step, and something to tell the lads. That left Bella, Mr. Lionel Hope, Mrs. McCabe, Mrs. Selwa Gardner, and the two recovered tomb raiders in the parlour, hoping to make sense of the last threads of this whole strange affair. The first thing I should say is that there is no doubt at all that the creature inhabiting the body of the former Nellie Tunbridge killed Charlotte Hathaway, said Mrs. McCabe, sipping a glass of tomato juice that Mrs. Teapot had produced for her, seemingly out of nowhere, when the lady said she did not drink wine. Everyone else had a small glass of port in front of them, though Colin produced a rather large bottle of whisky from behind a hidden compartment of one of the dressers, and set it on the tea table with a rebellious expression. "But how?" asked Bella. "She swore that she didn't, in sanguinary. No one can lie in that language." "I asked her about that before she was transferred into the custody of the Ministry for Magical Miscreants," said Mrs. McCabe. "It's all a matter of semantics, as is common when linguists turn evil. You didn't ask her if she killed Charlotte. You asked if she cursed her. According to not Professor Tunbridge, Pharaoh's words are a blessing, not a curse." "She really turned Charlotte to bronze with a single word," said Colin, shivering. "Poor old Charlie." "It wasn't the first time," said Mrs. McCabe. 5 years ago, shortly after his article was published about the missing Mr. Gardner and Mr. Hathaway, a Mr. Gaston Hugo was found in his apartment, his body transmuted into lead. He was under ministry surveillance at the time, so we knew that no one had entered or left the apartment for 12 hours before he was found. He did, however, receive a single telephone call. "You knew," said Lionel, looking ill. "All this time you knew what had happened to him. Even Gaston's family don't know for sure that he's dead." "The investigation was ongoing," said Mrs. McCabe, looking uncomfortable. "Professor Tunbridge was a suspect, as were you, as were several members of the Gardner and Hathaway families. But nothing could be proved until now." "Poor Mr. Hugo," said Selwa, with unexpected compassion. "We met him, you know, me and Charlotte, when he was researching that article. She called him a vulture, sent him off with a flea in his ear, but he kept coming back. And we eventually agreed to listen to his theories. I convinced her to change her mind about him," said Lionel, looking wretched. "He was a good friend, and he kept his sources anonymous right to the end. According to that Tunbridge woman and everyone else on the team," Selwa went on, one hand clutching at Tag's sleeve, like she couldn't bear to let go of him, "the last foot of the entrance to the tomb was uncovered at dusk. Everyone agreed not to enter the tomb until dawn. Tunbridge woke up early, found you two missing, and assumed you'd jumped ahead and gone into the tomb on your own, or that one of you had, and the other followed, because goodness knows you weren't capable of letting each other win," she added, with a stern look for both Tag and Colin that was somehow softer than anything her face had done during Bella's entire acquaintance with her. "Sounds about right," said Tag unapologetically. "That is literally what happened," said Colin. They clinked port glasses. "Professor Tunbridge? Well, no, not a professor then, was she? That came later. I can't believe they awarded a full teaching professorship to a reanimated corpse," complained Tag. "Not the first time, eh?" said Colin. "Anyway, her," went on Selwa. She and a team went into the tomb together. But they said there was no footsteps in the dust and no evidence that either of you had set foot inside the tomb. So they all agreed you'd left camp for your own reasons and met a mysterious death elsewhere. Selwa lifted her chin, not showing an inch of emotion. Lies, said Colin. Damned lies, added Tag. Indeed, added Lionel, in a dark growl of a voice. Gaston started his investigations 5 years ago for a puff piece. Whatever happened to Gardner and Hathaway? He used to get drunk and read the funniest of the conspiracy theories out loud to me over the telephone. You ran off and joined the circus. You were eaten by ants. The tomb was entirely faked. But then he realized that every member of the team that entered the tomb with Professor Tunbridge died in the decade that followed. The jovial expressions fell off Tag and Colin's faces.
What? All of them? Said Colin. Half of them were students. Kids younger than us.
You mean the ones who went into the tomb with Nellie?
Not Nellie, Tag corrected. No, said Lionel. Not only the ones who went into the tomb. Every single one of them.
There were 18 people on that dig, said Colin, sounding numb.
Indeed, said Lionel. No one had picked up on it before, Gaston. None of the deaths were suspicious, or if they were, they were suspicious in obvious ways. A woman strangled at the hands of her husband. 3 postgrads in a drunken punting accident. Hospital complication. Vampire bite gone bad. It happened slowly, so carefully over so many years, and in so many different countries, archaeologists being the vagabonds that they are. No one put together the one event they all had in common. Not even to suggest they'd been cursed. A leading cause in the deaths of most archaeologists, if you read newspapers. 10 of them were actually rumoured to be under some form of curse. By a phantasm from an altogether different tomb raiding incident.
Well, if you will steal shiny things from the monstrous divine, Mrs. Macabre murmured.
Meanwhile, Tunbridge became a famous professor, credited with finding the Tomb of Brass and the Gargoyle Hoard, Selwa said in disgust. After Mr. Hugo fell off the face of the earth, Charlotte was fired up all over again to find out what happened to our boys. And we figured the only way to be sure we hadn't missed anything was to collect the recovered artifacts, give them the old once-over. So, we started nicking them.
Ma, said Tag, sounding embarrassed and proud all at once. From museums?
Museums stole them in the first place, Selwa shrugged. And don't pretend the two of you wouldn't have been fighting over those gargoyles like cats in heat. I blame Charlotte, though. It was her plan.
Ugh, Charlie. Spitfire to the end, said Colin sadly.
Pour a glass out in her honour, he suggested to Tag. They both emptied the last of their port onto the carpet and reached for the whiskey bottle, scuffling over it like children.
Really? Bella demanded. Boys will be boys, said Mrs. Teapot cheerfully, as a mop whisked in out of nowhere to clean up the mess. We've missed you, Master Colin.
Good to be home, Mrs. T, Colin replied.
Bella rather felt like she was losing control of the situation.
But the bronze key was still around her neck.
Don't you think it's time you gave us the real story? The two of you.
Tag Gardner and Colin Hathaway glanced at each other.
I mean, said Colin amiably.
We have all this whiskey.
Thank you for listening to Sheep Might Fly.
This podcast was recorded on Palawa land. I acknowledge and pay respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal people as the traditional and continuing custodians of Lutruwita, Tasmania.
Sheet Might Fly is produced and edited by Andrew Finch. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Instagram, Blue Sky, or Threads at TansyRR. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of bonus rewards, early ebooks, and exclusive stories for a small monthly pledge. This month, as I mentioned previously, there is a bonus short story for people at the bonus ebook level and above, which is $2 a month, which is a Wodehousian fairy tale. And those at the $3 a month tier, which is the backstage pass, among other rewards, including that bonus story. They also get access to the fiction serial I am publishing at the moment, which will eventually become Teacup Magic number 6, This Enchanted Island. It kind of has pirates in it. I'll see you next week for more Curse of Bronze.